On the wall of Pete Townsend's West London office is a framed relic of his past, the shattered remains of a Rickenbacker guitar, one of the many which he smashed to pieces on stage in the 1960s.
Yeah, they were equivalent to about 3,500 quid. I paid 385 for the first one I've smashed.
You realised straight away that it could have an effect on the audience, that it was incendiary.
It was redemptive, I think, and releasing.
Redemption has been a returning theme of Pete Townsend's work ever since, from the howls of teenage angst in his early songs for The Who and through the psychological drama of his concept albums Quadrophenia and Tommy. And it's a theme which continues through the 500-plus pages of Townsend's autobiography, Who I Am. The book details his upbringing as the son of working musicians. His father was a saxophonist, his mother a singer. He enrolled at art school before realising that rock and roll offered a far more effective means of creative expression in the post-war years, one in which noise and destruction played a key role.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton,
throughout the 60s and 70s, The Who were one of the biggest bands in the world, certainly the loudest. They played at Woodstock, at Live Aid, at Live 8, and most recently, the Olympics closing ceremony, despite the deaths of two founder members, drummer Keith Moon and bassist John Entwistle. Pete Townsend's memoir documents life as an international rock star, but it also seeks to explain his arrest in 2003 after admitting that he'd entered his credit card details on a child pornography website. There was no evidence to suggest he had actually downloaded child pornography. Townsend insisted at the time that he was researching the subject, believing that he himself had been abused when he was young. In the book, he also reveals that he first signed a contract to write an autobiography in 1996. So is this book 16 years in the making?
No, I did a year of writing in 96, presented the first third of what's here to my publishers in New York, and they felt it wasn't quite right. And my thesis in writing the book originally, it has changed, but back then it was not a biography as such. It was a rather more lofty idea, which was to try to talk about the shift, the change that happened between 1959 and 1963, when the function of the pop song changed. And the reason why I felt that I could write about it was because of my upbringing as the son of a pop musician who was in a dance band, and the fact that I could really see and feel when this change happened, because of the fact that, you know, that I kind of overthrew my dad, who was a saxophone player. The guitar replaced the saxophone. And that made me very acutely aware of the fact that something had changed in what music was expected to do. And that's what my book was about. Little Brown, who were my publisher there, released me from the contract. I paid back the advance, but they released me because they felt they wanted a book that would do what this book does. You know, the sex and the drugs and the rock and roll. It's pathetic, but there it is, you know.
Rock and roll has always been about generational challenge and uprooting what has gone before. But as you say, there was a different challenge with your father because you were challenging his musical orthodoxy. He didn't particularly encourage you to play, did he? I mean, he had instruments around the house. The only one that you were allowed to play was, what, the clarinet?
No, I wasn't allowed to touch his clarinet. No, absolutely not. I remember trying to play it once and I got terribly told off. No, I was allowed to play mouth organs, which I bought myself with my pocket money. No, he didn't think I had any musical talent. I'm not very good at maths, so I couldn't read music. And that was what he was trained to do. He was trained to read music. He was a brilliant reader. He used to practice this incredibly elaborate, classical-trained exercises, and then go off to a gig and play very, very simple American Air Force dance music, you know, Glenn Miller type stuff. Da, 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 you know, and that's about as complicated as it got. But he couldn't get it that music could be made any other way.
It's a book largely about writing great songs, playing huge gigs. But, I mean, the overall impression that you get reading this book is of a lot of confusion and despair throughout your life. And that's expressed in a lot of the songs, a lot of the early Who songs, the questioning, who am I, what is my identity, not being able to explain. Did writing the book and exploring all of that back history and, you know, who you are, did it surprise you how unhappy apparently you were as a young man and as a kid?
I wouldn't call it unhappy. I don't know whether this is the right expression. I've described myself as manic depressive, which I think is a clinical condition, but I had huge mood swings. So I could be quite sad. I wouldn't say depressed, but I could be quite sad for quite long periods of time, and I could be extremely happy for quite long periods of time. So my mood swings were huge. What I realised, I suppose, is that the thesis for me as a songwriter, my purpose as a songwriter was to serve the kids around me. That was all I cared about, and that's still all I care about. I don't want to write songs that release some inner turmoil in me. You know, I've done the therapy.
You were giving voice to the inarticulate kids around
you. That's what I felt I was doing. Right. It felt to me to be a great honour to be given that job. And I was given that job. I wrote Can't Explain, and a deputation came to see me, and they said, write more like this. And I thought, well, you know, I'm an artist. I've been given a commission. People try to put us to death. Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around. That's an extraordinary moment, actually, because you say a delegation came, it's after a gig, a gang of mods who would come and see them and said, write about us more.
Yeah, that's
right. You are saying what we are thinking,
that's
we are unable to
that's
say
right.
it.
That's right, exactly right. Obviously, I was drawing on my own experience. Don't try to dig what we all say. I've always had this strong connection with... not with the underdog, that's not what it's about, but with the part of us all that we carry, which is vulnerable, damaged, tragic, sad, and it might just be 1% of most people. But in the neighbourhood I grew up, it seemed to be more like 10 to 15%. In other words, every boy that I knew, and many of the young women, seemed to have some part of them that needed to be spoken to, that needed to come out of denial, because our parents had survived 50 years of war by living in complete denial. Why don't you all fade away? Yeah, don't try to dig what we all say. What's most interesting was the way that resonated with the people around me. Mm. So, guess what? They must have experienced very similar things. And what I found was that when I went to America for the first time, 67, 68, I realised that Tommy was touching people, yet particularly young people there, very, very, very deeply, because even though they hadn't had such an acute bump of the post-war problem that we had, you know, no sugar, no bread, no butter, no potatoes, you know, that kind of thing, no fun. Although they still had this kind of fairly fabulous life after the war, the way that we saw it anyway, they still had this deep scar. You know, the kids would look at their parents and kind of say to them, what were you thinking?
Yes.
And Tommy somehow gave this idea that there was a way that we ourselves could find our way out. It was the idea that the Messiah function, the presidential function, the Winston Churchill function was now counterfeit. And what did we have instead? We had Elvis Bloody Presley. He was our new president. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't enough. And so when that music of the 60s came along, probably accompanied by, you know, in America, quite a lot of LSD and everything else changes, but for them too, the Vietnam War, there was this schism. So Tommy touched them too. So my experience as a child somehow embraced and, what's the word, it kind of helped my songs get across to young Americans as well, because Tommy was without question massively successful.
Lyrically, you were right. Tapping into those post-war anxieties and generational change. But even before that,
but also pointing, for example, the fact that Tommy ends with a prayer: "See me, feel me, touch me, heal me. Listening to you, I get the music. Following you, I get the heat." You know,
prayer. By now, it's the age of Aquarius, isn't it?
But this is a proper prayer. And you know, when we played at Woodstock, you know, and we suddenly I'd watch Sly and the Family Stone do they? We're going to get you high. Over and over again for a little bit too long. And
like a mantra.
Yeah, a mantra. I decided to do the same thing with the end of Tommy, and this sleepy audience, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, woke up, stood up, raised their hands to the heaven and started to pray.
There's an extraordinary description early on in the book when you are on a boat on the Thames and you're describing the sound of the engine, the thud of the engine and the swirl of the river, and you say you started hearing music, you could imagine symphonic music in your head, and you say, "I've never heard such music since, and my personal ambition has always been to rediscover that sound and to relive its effects on me." And you were, what, 12 years old or something?
When that happened, I was about 11 or 12. Yeah, probably 11. I'd had a couple of incidents of it prior to that with my Aunt Trilby, who had a piano. It was the only piano I could ever get at. And it was badly tuned. And she lived above my father's mum and dad in Ealing. And I used to go and see her. She was an adorable lady, you know, quite eccentric. You know, would read the tarot and stuff like that. But she would let me noodle about on the piano, and I would find a couple of keys that resonated, that rattled, that caused overtones, and I would lose myself in it, playing the same two notes over and over again. This is when I was about 6 or 7.
Yeah.
And then I would stop, and I would be in this trance, because what I was hearing was not the two notes I was playing on the piano, but something else. And one day it was a particularly profound experience, and I was quite dizzy, and I came out of it. And she said to me, "That's wonderful." And I turned to her and I went, "I know."
But that's the encouragement you needed.
Yeah,
and
so, it felt to me like she heard what I heard, because she was such an eccentric and kind of new age type lady.
Right.
And then the incident on the Thames was quite different and quite pivotal, because what followed that trance that I went into was that I was abused as a young boy. It could have got much worse. This is the only abuse that I remember, by the way, the specific abuse, which was by two Sea Scout guys who hauled me out semi-conscious and got me into a shower, stripped me off, and then started to get up to their stuff between themselves while I was in the shower. So the combination for me of this extraordinary revelatory music and this bizarre and really quite disgusting event that happened has always been difficult for me to deal with, because it felt to me like I'd heard this God-given music and then been dragged down into what, you know, in the East they call the mire, you know, the mud of life.
And you've always kept those two memories together. They have always been intertwined.
Unfortunately, yeah. And it's interesting that bit of the river where it happened, and this was something I discovered much later, that stretch of the river between Kew Gardens and Richmond was the stretch of the river on which I was born. I was born in a place called Nazareth House, which is by Sion Park.
Mm. And that's where you heard this music.
Right outside.
The auditory equivalent of a vision, then, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, I think so. And I've written a lot about it since. The new piece that I'm working on, Floss, is about a young man who hears something much more horrific. He hears music all the time, but he also hears the coming apocalypse. He hears what he thinks is the coming apocalypse.
Mm. It was interesting when I was reading that description of the boat and the swirling waters, it suddenly made me think that you have written about the sea quite a lot. There's a song called "I Am the Sea," "Love Rain Over Me," there's a reference to the sea, "Drowned," all of those songs, in fact, from Quadrophenia,
that's
so
right,
I suppose.
Yeah.
But it is a recurring image, and I wonder if it goes back to that very first auditory vision, as I described
it. It's sad that I can't remember the time that I lived with my grandmother. I know it was there were 2 years that I lived with my grandmother as a very little kid. My mum and dad split up briefly, and my mum didn't know what to do with me, and she sent me down to her grandmother. And I write about it in the book. What I write about isn't much because I don't remember much, but I know it was very creepy, very, very, very creepy time. But we were by the sea. We were in Westgate. We walked by the sea. We walked past the bench often. I didn't know at the time, of course, where T.S. Eliot wrote part of The Wasteland in Margate. But
there are these conflicting memories because your grandmother, Denny, your maternal grandmother, Denny, was, as the in the way that you remember it, the way you describe it, she's mentally unbalanced. And strange episodes when she would go over to the bus garage across the road and pick up bus drivers.
I don't know whether she would pick them up. What was actually going on was very difficult for me to understand because I was so little. Mm. So what actually happened was a bit later, I went to my mum, probably back in 1993, 94. I just put Tommy up in America. I'd done a lot of interviews, and I started to realise that there was stuff in Tommy that revealed that something had possibly happened to me. I'd gone through several years of deep Jungian-based, dream-based therapy and got to a point where my therapist had said, you know, you really need to try to write through what happened. And, you know, in a sense, self-hypnotic regression. And I couldn't do it. I started to break down physically and I couldn't do it.
What, when you got too close to the actual memory?
Yeah, and whatever that memory is, I haven't yet remembered. But anyway, so I went to see my mother and I said, listen, tell me about it. And she was so evasive, it took me hours to get it out of her. I did what you're doing to me now. I sat with a microphone and I kept shoving it in her face. Tell me what happened, what happened? And eventually she revealed some terrible things about the way she and my dad had treated me. And bizarrely, I loved her for it because it was so courageous of her to tell me. She came out looking so bad, but it filled in this gap for me. What had actually happened was that she and my dad had split up, young lovers after the war. I'd been born. My dad was working with the Squadron Airs, travelling everywhere. My mother was young, glamorous. She'd falsified her age to join the RAF. She was everywhere we went as a little boy. I can remember men following us. And she had a lover, and I was a problem.
But reading the book, you are incredibly hard on yourself throughout your life. I mean, if there was another author's name on the cover of this book, I would read it as a hatchet job. Do you think you are particularly self-critical?
Self-critical, you know, I wanted the book to be honest. You know, my drinking years and you know, I talk a lot about wanting to be a good husband
and failing.
Mm. But God, you know, am I being hard on myself saying that?
But I mean, your ex-wife Karen comes across as a heroic figure in this book, I've got to say, because she seemed to put up with a hell of a lot.
I don't know that's true. I don't want to be unfair to her. I don't know that that's true. I think what I didn't want to do is she didn't want to be in the book at all. Mm. What wife would, you know, she said, by all means, write your life story, but leave me out of it. And I said, you know, really, I can't. I have to write about you. And I wouldn't call her heroic. What I would say is that because her father was a working musician, she understood. Mm. And, you know, so she knew that, for example, when I came back from a tour and I shut myself immediately away in my studio to write the next bunch of songs for the next Who album, when I should have been reacquainting myself with my family, she understood.
Is it true to say that that sense of duty that you're talking about, that need to explore and to self-analyse, led you to, I mean, what you have described as the darkest period of your life? When you are looking to the roots of, you know, whether you were abused as a child, led you to look at abuse, child abuse on the internet?
But
you started looking to see what was out there and you were trying to, and you write about it in the book, that you were trying to reveal how the banks were complicit with internet child pornography.
I don't think now that we have to even go there. You know, we know that the banks are complicit with pornography on the internet.
But it was a big mistake to think that you needed to do that because.
Well, are we here to have a conversation about how naughty I was?
No, I'm not saying that. But I mean, it was a misguided sense of duty.
With respect to the book, on this particular topic, you know, you have to read the book. Mm. You know, I accepted a caution from the police, which led to me being labelled as a sex offender. But, you know, I did nothing wrong. Mm. And
but do you, and you describe that in harrowing detail, the whole of the interview process.
What was harrowing about it was the press coming and...
And standing outside the
house.
Well,
not just that, but the way that the tabloids handled the appearance of my name. You know, the fact is that, you know, that what happened was is that I didn't enter the website, but I did make the credit card transaction.
You paid $7 to...
Which I immediately cancelled.
Yeah.
And I got a letter from a policeman who headed up the investigation 3 or 4 days ago, who said, we knew that. We knew that you weren't a paedophile. We knew that you weren't a child molester. We knew you were, in a sense, on the side of the angels.
But in retrospect, do you not wish you hadn't made that decision to try and do something about it, to shine a spotlight on what was going on? Or do you stand by that?
I think I do stand by. I certainly can't change the past. I don't think it was the right thing to do for people that knew me and loved me.
Do you ever wish you'd gone to court rather than taking that caution?
I do wish that I'd had the courage and the strength to go to court, but I didn't.
Even it would have taken months of fighting.
It would have destroyed me, I think. I think a really clever QC could have really... You know, I've been triggered during this interview. I've become angry with you.
Mm.
And I think that if I was in the witness box, I would have... And a QC had said something to me that was insulting. I know who I am. I would have leapt out and killed him. But that wasn't the reason I didn't go to court. I didn't go to court because I was in shock at Kingston Police Station at the fact that the Crown Prosecution Service and the Home Secretary wouldn't let it pass. I just couldn't believe that they wouldn't let it pass. There was no evidence, except for the mea culpa of the credit card.
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, I was charged, cautioned, and put on the sex offenders register as a signal.
No one knows what it's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man behind blue eyes. No one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies. But my dream.
There's long been a perception that The Who were a band driven by, thrived on animosity and adversity between you and your frontman Roger Daltrey. But again, Roger Daltrey in the book comes across as your rock. He's an ardent supporter, not only as you as a songwriter, but after your arrest, he stood by you, didn't he?
He did, yeah, because he knows me. Yeah, he knows me. So.
And that unit, The Who, you talk, I mean, there's a great sense of camaraderie. I mean, you lost a lot of your hearing to The Who, but you also lost a couple of very good friends. And losing John Entwistle, you describe that moment when he died, and it is very touching, it's very affecting, and it's clear that you didn't really see that one coming.
No, I didn't. No, not in the way... I think none of us saw it coming in the way that we knew Keith would one day fizzle. Although Keith's death is a surprise, I hope that comes across, because he was recovering. He was working on his recovery. Mm. You know, when Keith died, although he died of an overdose of drugs, it was an overdose of prescribed drugs that he rather carelessly over-medicated.
Yeah, to try and get him off the booze.
Yeah. But he had a chunk of time clean, what I would call clean. You know, he wasn't doing cocaine and he wasn't drinking. And that was the period where I realised that I had a real friendship with Keith, because every night before bed he would call me up and say, I've just called to say I love you. And I would say, what do you want? And he said, that's all. Put the phone down. And in the end, I think my wife got a bit irritated with it, because he used to do it at like 1 in the morning, you know. So it was a bit of a shock too. But those two losses are one of the reasons why Roger and I think, decided in a sense that whatever didn't work about our relationship, and there's quite a bit that doesn't. The most important thing that doesn't work about Roger and I is that we can't write songs together. Roger has ideas and he just needs somebody to help. And the person that would be best to do it would be me. But when Roger and I sit in a room together, we look in each other's eyes. We're shy of each other. It's quite extraordinary. We're shy of each other. So we can't get past... We can't get
after all these years?
Yeah, we can't get to that place of intimacy. So that's the only thing. But everything else between us has never, ever been better.
You made the decision in 1978, after Keith Moon's death, to carry on with a new drummer. Kenny Jones from The Faces joined you. After John Entwistle died, you carried on again. And you were there at the Olympics in the stadium closing ceremony, you and Roger Daltrey, now are The Who, with other musicians. But you must look around that stage. You must see empty spaces. Are you not aware of the loss when you're playing, or has it become a new band?
It's The Who without with a couple of people missing. I think this is what happens to the working men's club when the old ones die, but there's still a few left, and that's it. You know, I'm 67 years old, Roger's a year older than me, and I pretty soon will be 70. I don't particularly want to do a Tom Jones. I love Tom, but I don't know whether I want to be doing that. But I think what we evoke is we evoke The Who. I don't think Roger likes it when I do this. I don't know whether he does or he doesn't. He doesn't argue with me on it face to face. But I think I regard it, and maybe it's not the right word. I use the word brand. When we stand together, we are a brand. We evoke The Who brand. And I think The Who brand has become synonymous with maybe at the most 10 extraordinary pieces of music, but also with the mod movement, with London swinging 60s. You know,
you're happy to be regarded as a heritage act then?
Absolutely, yeah.
You're quite happy to now just do occasional shows and for it to be looking to the past.
As The Who, under The Who, what would anybody want Roger and I to do? You know, I think if Roger and I want to do a new album of country and western songs, I could write them, he could sing them, we could go to Nashville and record them, and then we could drag ourselves around America and play gig after gig after gig, and then I could sit here with you and say, you know, I find it all incredibly fulfilling, you know, and but I don't. I never have. I've never enjoyed performing. It's never troubled me. I've always found it easy. But I've never really liked the road. I've never really liked, you know, I've never really liked that sense of being on a stage and having to work. It seems to me that the stage is not a place to work, but that's how it feels to me.
Did it feel like work at the Olympics closing ceremony? How was that?
No, that's very different. You know, and I found it incredibly moving, but also uplifting. Our bit, they gave us the whole thing. You know, they gave us this triumph of this country of ours. They gave it to us. And as we walked on with the tiddly-tiddly electronic music of Barbara O'Reilly, which I composed on an organ in my bedroom in 1971 as a young man trying to write hits for The Who, the flame goes out. We put out the flame. So it was absolutely extraordinary. And what was extraordinary was being in the stadium and knowing, having a sense, a real sense, that what was going on in the stadium was what I've always believed was the great moment for me in rock, was when we realised that when we gather in large numbers and we lose ourselves in the crowd, we're going onto a higher plane. It's brief, but it's one of the reasons why there are 450 music festivals a year in the UK alone right now, is that if you get that even for a moment, it's a fabulous feeling.
And what better soundtrack than The Who to celebrate that?
Thank you.
Pete Townsend, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.